Good evening, I'm an alcoholic, my name is Warren. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Nice, quiet weekend to kick back and enjoy yourself and to have some comradeship with others from various other areas throughout Ohio and even some friends of ours who are coming down from Canada. And I don't imagine that Bob has planned too much this evening for his lead, seeing as he had about 30 seconds or so to prepare for it, which is really good in a lot of cases, because sometimes those that come strictly from the heart at a very short period of time are the best leads that we have the opportunity of giving. But I've been fortunate enough to know this gentleman for quite a few years since he came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen a tremendous amount of growth within him and also within the family. His lovely wife is very active and well in her program, which means a lot of support for those of us who are alcoholics. You know, and just to give a little bit of a plug for those ladies, you know, any one of us can come into Alcoholics Anonymous, but you have to know someone to get an Al-Anon. So she's doing a pretty good job. So to make a real short story, Bob has come a long, long way, and he has a tremendous story and a lot of knowledge to input to others as well. And he works the steps within his life, and he works with others. And that's the reason that basically we're here, is that we're here for each other. And with that, I'd like to give you my friend Bob.
Good evening. I'm Bob Keel. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm not Carolyn. That was to be your lead. I'm not a woman. I've had a lot of problems before recovery and since recovery, but that ain't one of them. As Warren said, I didn't have much time to get nervous about this lead, so that's nice. And I haven't had much time to think about it, although I've thought about it for the last 18 years. My sobriety date is February 17th, 1987, and for that I am grateful. Certainly without the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd be in a different place today. I don't know where I'd be, but I wouldn't be as happy and joyous and free as I am now. I was real sick before I took my first drink, and just because I got sober, that didn't change much. I was just dry. I wasn't growing spiritually, and I wasn't growing emotionally, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It's about growing. For me, it's about growing spiritually and emotionally, and that I'm really grateful. But I was born in Cory, Pennsylvania a few years ago, and when I was an infant, my biological parents got divorced, and so I went with my mother, and she moved to Erie, Pennsylvania, and my brother and my natural father stayed in Cory, Pennsylvania. So there was that dysfunction that was in my childhood, and there was all that goes along with divorce and separation. And I always had this feeling that I missed my brother more than my father. And I suppose there was a feeling of abandonment there. And then when I was growing up, when I was in like 8 or 9 or 10, I would go visit my natural father for the few weeks. And then at some point, I stopped visiting him again. And I think there was that abandonment again. So I had trust issues that I brought from my childhood, that I brought to AA, that I brought to my marriage, and I think it stemmed from that. And so I had this ache, this emptiness, this hole in the soul, and that was part of it. But I think when I was born in February 28, 1946, I was born one drink below being normal. I needed a drink then. You know, there was this emptiness, this hole in the soul. Part of it was the divorce, but part of it was just my nature. And I'm not blaming my alcoholism on my family of origin, because I had the genetic predisposition that if I would have been born into a family that was perfect, if I was born of Mary and Joseph, I would have still been an alcoholic, because alcohol did something for me that it doesn't do for other people, and it does the same thing for a lot of you people. I went with my mother, and she remarried, and so I grew up with my stepfather and my mother in Erie, Pennsylvania. And I had this emptiness, this hole in the soul, this somehow I felt on the outside looking in, no matter where I was at. And I tried all kinds of ways of fixing that. I thought that maybe if I was a star athlete, that would make me feel accepted and give me some self-esteem. So I tried all kinds of things. But when you're 128 pounds and there's five of those pounds are pimples, you're not gonna be a fullback on the football team, or you're not gonna be a quarterback on the football team. So I went out for swimming, and I was an okay swimmer on a swimming team. You know, I wasn't the star in the swimming team. I was good enough to get a couple letters on the swimming team, but I wasn't the star. I wasn't an All-American. There was All-Americans on our team. But my goal was to get a scholarship to college on the swimming team. And there was one flaw in that thought process. I couldn't swim fast enough. You know, and they didn't give me a scholarship, and that pissed me off. So I got even with those people that I started to smoke cigarettes, and then I started smoking when I was 18, and I bought one pack of cigarettes on a daily basis for the next 22 years, because any day I was going to quit, and I didn't want to get stuck with a whole carton of cigarettes. That was my thinking. That was the way I thought before alcohol was a problem. I was sick. I just didn't have... That's the way alcoholics think. So sports didn't cut it. I thought I could be I could join Hell's Angels and be a tough guy. Again, when you're 128 pounds, 5 pounds worth of pimples, and you drive a Vespa motor scooter, it's hard to join. It's hard to join Hell's Angels, you know. But you know, I was a giant in my mind at the time, and so that didn't work. And I was a lousy juvenile delinquent. One time, I stole some booze and stayed out overnight with my friends, and we tried to steal a car that had broken down at the side of the road. See, it didn't occur to me that the car had broken down because the car didn't run. And these two or three 16-year-olds that were drunk were going to try to get us started and go joyriding. We did not get it started, and so we went to sleep beside the car. And in the morning, the police stopped by and asked us what was happening. That was the type of juvenile delinquent I was. I was just incompetent. I was not good at it. Now, fortunately, if I was good at it, that might have been a bigger problem, but I didn't pursue that path because I was an incompetent juvenile delinquent, and I had a great fear of authority. You know, I feared police. And so I didn't pursue that career. And I thought school was the answer. I thought if I got the right education, the right job, that would make me whole on the inside. What I was looking at was something outside of myself was going to make me whole on the inside. And you all know that that was doomed to failure, but at the time it sounded like a good idea. I also was introduced to alcohol. Now, I had been given alcohol when I was growing up in my family of origin, my stepfather, and my mother would give me drinks of alcohol when I was growing up. I'd have sips and so on. So I had been introduced to alcohol before. And my stepfather's family was the type of family that if there was a family get-together, people drank a lot and people had a good time. And so I got out of that was alcohol, good time. And some of those people, I'm sure, were alcoholics, but, you know, I don't know how many of them were. I know some of them died alcoholic deaths, so I guess that means that there was alcohol in that family, but not everybody was an alcoholic. And some of them drank and had a good time, and they went home and they went to work, and that was it. But I got the message that if you were going to have a good time, you had to drink. That's the message I got. And when I was about 12 or 13, I stole alcohol. I had a paper route, and I would steal alcohol from the customers on my paper route. I would see where they would hide or store the beer in their garage, and I'd go and relieve them of their excess. And if, you know, some of those people I probably owe amends to, but, you know, they're... some of them are long gone. And I was also an altar boy, and I stole the altar wine, and I got drunk on that. So, and alcohol did for me, it took away that emptiness, that hole in the soul. It made me feel whole. It made me feel comfortable in my skin. And alcohol worked for me, and that's why I'm an alcoholic. Alcohol did for me what it doesn't do for 90% of the population. Alcohol made me feel whole, made me feel like I really could join Hell's Angels and drive a Vespa motor scooter. It made me feel like I was 6'4" and weighed 200 pounds and, you know, all muscle. And it made me feel that way. And that's what alcohol did for me. And that's why I'm an alcoholic. It made me forget that I had this hole in the soul. It made me forget that I didn't feel as good as you looked on the outside. That's why I'm an alcoholic. It had nothing to do with my parents getting divorced. It had nothing to do with my stepfather. It had nothing to do with any of that. It had to do with the fact that alcohol twisted the way I thought and felt. And that's the way it is for me. And the way it is for me today, if I try something and it makes me feel good, I'm going to do it again. That's why I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, I have never done crack cocaine, but I have a good idea it would be a bad idea for me to try it. So I tried alcohol at school. And about this, and when I was a senior in high school, my stepfather was dying from... his addiction to nicotine. He was dying from cancer of the lung. And that was at the time I started to smoke cigarettes. I mean, that's a form of insanity. I mean, I knew that he was dying from cancer of the lung, and I knew it was from nicotine. But I started smoking cigarettes because it wasn't going to happen to me. And I was going to quit any day. And so... so he died, and my original plan was to go to a medical school, but because the finances had changed with his death, I changed my major from pre-med to pre-pharmacy, and then I went to pharmacy school. I graduated from high school in Erie, and I went to 2 years to college in Erie, Pennsylvania, and then I went to the University of Pittsburgh School of Pharmacy. And at that time, well, let me just go back that, you know, when I was in high school, I was brought home by the police on three separate occasions, and they were all alcohol related. You know, when I, one time, I were throwing rocks at a street sign, I was drunk. One time I was driving and the police stopped us and let us go without searching the car, and then the same cop stopped us 30 miles away from us. I mean, talk about luck. I was just a bad... Anyhow, he searched the car again and he found the alcohol. And the other time was when we had the incident with the broken down car. The point being that every time I got in trouble, alcohol was there already. You know, I was never a social drinker. When the first time I got drunk was the end of my social drinking, and that occurred at age 12 or 13. Because every time I drank after that, it was to get high, to get loaded, to get that feeling, to take away that emptiness, that hole in the soul, to give me that buzz, to give me that intoxication feeling that we all know so well. That's what it was. I have no idea what social drinking is about. Why would you want to drink socially? Why would you get a glass of wine and drink half of it? I mean, that's just foreign to me. I think it's stupid. but that's my point of view. So I went to the University of Pittsburgh School of Pharmacy, and now I was living outside of the house. I was living away from my mother. I was on my own. I actually started to live in a fraternity house. And so my priorities were that I would have a good time. I would work enough to support having a good time. And if I had time left to go to school, I would do that. And that was my priorities. So what that meant was that we would party hard, and I would work a lot of hours in pharmacies, and once in a while I would literally go to school. I would go to school less than 10% of the time. So when it would come time for final examinations, I had never been to class. So what I would do is I would mimeograph my friends' notes that they took, and I'd like to tell people that this is why IBM and Xerox did so well in the early 60s, because I was mimeographing so much. And then I would study all night while I was working in pharmacies, and I didn't have, and when you're studying all night, you can take coffee or you can take something else. I had access to the something else, and so I took amphetamines. Now, I didn't abuse those. I just took them to help me to study. Now, if I would get a little buzz on, that was just a tolerable side effect that I would put. And I was living in Shadyside in Pittsburgh, and at that time, I'm dating myself, but that was kind of a hippie haven. So I was living in this fraternity house that we were taking these drugs that we were sacrificing for society. And a block away, these dirty drug addicts were taking the same drugs, and they should arrest those people. That was my thinking and my self-justification. And about this time, I met my wife, and we got married, and we had a child. And she had the child. And I graduated from pharmacy school, and we moved to Maryland. And we lived on the eastern shore of Maryland for 2 years. And now I had a college degree, I had a career, and I was making more money than I ever made before, I ever thought. And certainly I was making a good living at that time. And, the concept was, the bill of goods that I had believed, that if I got the right college degree and got married and had a family, I'd be whole on the inside. I'd be happy. There was one flaw in that thought pattern, that nothing had really changed on the inside. There was still that 128-pound kid with 5 pounds of pimples that really felt less than. And the college degree didn't fix that. And I was still drinking, and when I drank to get drunk. And I was working working in a hospital pharmacy, and I would also moonlight in other pharmacies. And I would put in a lot of hours at work. And so if I was tired, I would take something to help me with that. If I couldn't go to sleep, I would take something to help me with that. And it just reinforce the concept of better living through chemistry. And if there was a problem of living that I couldn't handle, there was a chemical that would make it better. Or if I thought there was a problem, I know there was a chemical to prevent that problem from occurring. And so that emptiness, that hole in the soul was still there. And nothing had changed. And I was a budding alcoholic. And if one's not good enough, two's better. If one college degree wasn't the answer, go back to school. That makes sense. So I went back, I went to the medical school. So we moved to Philadelphia, and we lived there for the next 6 or 7 years. Now I was married, had a child, I was going to medical school, and I couldn't afford to drink. I couldn't afford to drink from the standpoint that if I would drink, I couldn't have one. I mean, I never could have one, but I knew if I drank, that would ruin the rest of the day. I couldn't study, I couldn't work. So that's the way I had to control my drinking. I didn't realize that I was controlling my drinking. You know, when you have to control your drinking, it's out of control. So it was out of control then. It was out of control when I was an adolescent, but it got progressively worse. And, you know, at that point in my life, the only way I could control it was not drink. Of course, that's what I do now, but it was a different reason there. You know, I could not stop with my friends and have a drink because I couldn't stop then. You know, I would keep drinking and I couldn't afford the time. And alcohol was not an obsession yet. You know, I guess I was a problem drinker at that point. So that's how I controlled my alcohol. I was working a lot of hours and I was going to medical school and I had a daughter and my wife. And so I couldn't afford to drink a lot financially, but more about the time. And I was working a lot of hours. I still had access to chemicals, and I was taking uppers on a daily basis. And I would titrate the dose. I would take half of a tablet to help me to study at night. And again, it just reinforced there was better living through chemistry for me, and that the rules didn't apply to me. And that was a big deal. You know, now that I look at it, you know, I was committing felonies all those years. I was committing felonies for many, many years. Fortunately, I never got caught. But those are lines that I crossed, things that I did without even thinking about it. You know, and I was just so fortunate I didn't get caught, because I have colleagues that have got burnt for doing less than I have done. Anyhow, I crossed more and more lines, I crossed more and more bridges, my disease progressed. You know, if there was a chemical that would make me feel better, I would take it. If I thought peanut butter would give me a buzz on, I would take peanut butter. And, you know, this is at the time in the AA meetings that the dual alcoholics are the cross addicted. I guess those are Catholics, I don't know. But those that are, say, yeah, talk about drugs and alcohol, drugs and the pure alcoholics, whatever that means, you know, a pure alcoholic, please. But the pure alcoholics, you know, they get uptight. Well, I just promise you that I took drugs alcoholically. And the other thing is that, you know, Bob Smith, one of the founders of this program, he took drugs. And Bill Wilson, he took drugs. And so I'm in good company. The other thing is, as far as I know, they only introduced themselves as an alcoholic. And that's how I introduced myself. Anyhow, it was just reinforcing the concept of better living through chemistry. The rules didn't apply to me, whether it had to do with chemicals, driving, morality. Somehow they didn't apply to me. I was the exception. And so I graduated from medical school, and then I stayed in the Philadelphia area for another 3 or 4 years for advanced training. And now I wasn't working in pharmacies, so I didn't have access to, you know, helping myself to the pill bottles anymore. And I guess I was smart enough to know that it would be a bad idea to write a lot of prescriptions in my name. Because I knew how the legal system were. I knew that they really do keep track of this stuff. So I knew that, I didn't consciously think about it, but I just knew that that was probably a thing I didn't want to do. To leave a paper trail, I didn't want to do that. But I was now had advanced training, and I was had access to injectable drugs. And there came a time when I was at work at one of the hospitals, and they have some silly rules in the hospitals in Philadelphia that they don't like the doctors to walk around with a fifth of or a flask in their back pocket. You know, they take a dim view of that. So I was in a situation that I needed something to make me feel okay on the inside. And I couldn't drink, but I had access to injectables. So what's the problem here? I mean, that's the way, you know, of course you inject a drug. I mean, and then, again, it was just one of those lines that I crossed again. And I didn't even think about it. There was no debate. Should I? Of course. You know, I know how to do this. I know the pharmacology. I know this. I know that. And somehow the rules don't apply to me. And so I crossed that line. That was another line that I crossed and never looked back. And I finished my training in Philadelphia, and we moved to Erie, Pennsylvania for some reason. Somehow we got there. I guess we're supposed to be there. And so now I had two college degrees, so that should make me twice as filled up on the inside. I certainly was making more money. I had a career. I had a certain amount of prestige in the professional community. And there was this one fly in that ointment. That little kid that weighed 128 pounds, that had 5 pounds of pimples, that went to Pittsburgh, that went to Maryland, that went to Philadelphia, came back to Erie. Nothing really had changed on the inside. You know, none of those things made me whole. You know, I think it's so ironic that alcohol is called spirits, and I reached for alcohol to fill me up, and what I really wanted was a spiritual experience, a spiritual program. And I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find that. But so here I was in Erie, Pennsylvania. Nothing had changed on the inside. All the things on the outside looked terrific. I had two cars. I had a big house. I had a boat. You know, everything on the outside looked great, but everything on the inside was just rotting, just rotting. And my disease progressed. I was drinking more. I was hiding bottles in the basement. I was having blackouts. My wife tries to fool me to think that I went to a Willie Nelson concert, but I know we never went. I know. Yeah, and I was sober probably 5 or 10 years. I'm a physician, and I didn't realize that I was having blackouts. I just thought I had a bad memory for certain things. But anyhow, she swears we went to a Willie Nelson concert. God, I don't know. Anyhow, my disease progressed. I was taking drugs during the week, and I was drinking till I was passing out at night. I was drinking till I passed out on weekends, and my disease progressed. Things got worse. I was drinking more. I was taking more drugs to get me going. And ultimately, my wife found out that I was hiding booze in the basement, so I decided to stop doing that. So I stopped hiding the booze in the basement, and I decreased the amount that I was drinking, but I just took more drugs. Again, I took those drugs alcoholically, so that's why I'm discussing it. But my disease progressed, and ultimately I was confronted by my wife in the fall of 1986. And then You know, I was a closet drinker, closet user of drugs. I didn't drink to be social anymore. I didn't drink to go out and have a good time anymore. I just drank alone. I just took drugs alone. And it wasn't about being social. And I was becoming more negative, and more empty on the inside than I thought possible. And that was progressing. And in late September of 1986, my wife confronted me. Since we had no idea what to do about alcoholism, I said I would stop, and I found that I couldn't stop. You know, I really, really wanted to stop, and I couldn't stop. You know, I had also gone to a Koinonia weekend, and I had a spiritual experience, and that kept me sober for a good 12 hours. You know, it didn't work without AA, and I had a spiritual experience. You know, I felt the presence of my God, and that wasn't enough for me. And so she confronted me, and then, because we had no idea what to do about alcoholism, we talked to a counselor that we knew, and then I snuck out of town and went to the Carrion in Cincinnati, Ohio. And because I was an extremely intelligent and had two college degrees, the 28-day program only took me 35 days. But there I learned a few things. I learned that this was a disease. I was able to stay sober for 35 days, and I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the most important thing they did for me was to introduce me to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I knew that there was an answer in AA. I didn't know that there was an answer for me in AA, but I knew there was an answer in AA. So I snuck out of town, and then I snuck back into town, and I was going to live happily ever after. I was going to get a sponsor. I was going to interview a group of people when I got their names and phone numbers, and I was taking their names and phone numbers, but I waited too long. I waited too long. You know, I had some intellectual knowledge, but I didn't have recovery, and I didn't have a spiritual program, and I used one more time. I got intoxicated one more time, and then over the next 45 days I got intoxicated 15 more times, and I was right back where I started. I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, I was losing weight, and I did what I was told to do. I got a sponsor, and that person worked with me, and because I wasn't real busy in my work and he wasn't real busy in his work, I was able to see him on a daily basis, and I worked the steps with him. You know, on February 13th, 1987 was the day I realized that I couldn't stop on my own. That I realized that I understood what the word powerless meant to me. That if I have one drink, I'm going to have another one sooner or later. If I have one pill, I'm going to have another one sooner or later. And that's what I understood about powerless. And I also knew that there was an answer in AA. So on February 13th, I had the first step, and I had the second step, and I knew I wasn't a higher power, so I guess I had a third step. It wasn't the last day. I didn't get sober till the 16th, but the February 13th, which was Friday the 13th, was the luckiest day of my life because I took the first step. I understood what powerless meant to me, and that was a big deal. I didn't understand what that first step was about. I understood, I guess, the unmanageability of alcoholism, that, you know, my life wasn't a whole bed of cherry. I wasn't happy. But I didn't understand powerless, that I was powerless over alcohol. And on February 13th, that was the bottom. That was the bottom. And so I got my sponsor, and we worked the steps, and I did a fourth and fifth step with him. The first time around, it was at 6 months, and I was still in a fog. You know, when I got sober, the first 6 months was probably the worst 6 months of my life. It was worse than the last 6 months of my drinking, because then I had something to lean on. You know, if I was feeling real bad, I could drink. and it would take me someplace. Ultimately, at the end, it wouldn't take away all the pain, but it would deaden it a little bit. There was nothing to deaden it anymore. You know, son of a bitch, everything is real. That's what sober was about. You know, and when I never thought seriously about suicide before I got sober. The first 6 months, I had a plan, and I said, if it's as bad tomorrow as it is today, I'm going to commit suicide. Or other times I would say, if it's as bad tomorrow as it is today, I'm going to drink or drug. And I just put it off. And ultimately, there came a time when I was so depressed that I said, I felt that, you know, I'm still sober, but maybe it won't be so bad tomorrow. Something changed that maybe it won't be so bad tomorrow. And my depression started to lift. And I was sober and I was working the steps. That's what it was about. You know, if you stay around this program long enough and you work those steps, you will get better. Guaranteed. I guarantee it. I also guarantee it's going to take you longer than you want. I wanted 20 years of sobriety, 20 years of spiritual growth, and 20 years of spiritual enlightenment in the first 20 hours, the first 20 days. We all want that. We all want that. But that ain't the way it works. Some of us, it takes longer than others. But at 6 months, things started to change a little bit. I wasn't actively suicidal. And, you know, those first 6 months for me were real important, because I think it's a miracle that I got through those 6 months. I really don't know if I could get through those 6 months again. And if I relapse, I know it'd be hard on me. It'd be hard on my wife, and my wife would probably kill me. Because they were a black time in our life. Now, we've had some other difficult times, but they were a black time in our lives, in my life. And I don't want to go through that again. And I don't know if I can go through that again. It's certainly a lot easier to stay sober than get sober. So I worked the first three steps. And I did the fourth and fifth steps, and I made amends, and I was willing to have God remove the character defects from me. Now, I don't believe that my character defects, that all of them are ever going to be, or all of them were removed and will stay removed forever. They still keep popping up. But now at least I'm aware of what those character defects are. And unfortunately, the longer I'm sober, the longer I work the steps, the more I understand that there's more work to be done. But that's the gift of the program, that I can keep growing, that this is a spiritual journey, that I can keep on going, that things do get better, that I get more insight into myself, and I don't get as frustrated. You know, it used to be that when I would drive to work, I'd be yelling and screaming at the people in front of me. And now, when I yell and scream, I only chase them for a couple blocks now. It used to be miles. But now I'm getting better. This is better. This is, you know. And when the police pull me over to give me a speeding ticket, you know, I used to have resentments for months about that. Now, you know, it's a couple of days, and you know, maybe I shouldn't have been driving so fast. You know, maybe that he stopped me, that prevented me from getting in an accident. You know, my whole attitude has changed. I still get the tickets, but my attitude about them has changed. And I made amends. I made amends to myself. I made amends to my family, and I made amends to people that I have hurt. And I've also learned to modify my behavior so I don't have to keep making amends. That's one of the important things you get from this program. And I do a 10-step on a daily basis. I pray and meditate in the morning and in the evening, and at night I go over my day. And I go over my day and I compare them to the four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, love, and purity. And granted, I'm never close to them. But some days I'm closer than others. And I use them as a gauge to see where I really was out of sorts, or where I really took a turn where I don't want to go. You know, the steps in the 12-step program, and especially the 10-step, is a GPS system for me. It helps me to stay focused on the right line. You know, if you're traveling across Lake Erie, and if you're off 1 degree when you start out, by the time you get to the other side of Lake Erie, you're miles and miles and miles from where you thought you'd be. And I think sometimes our moral journey is the same. If I start to bend the rules and I start to justify my behavior, I can end up places I don't want to be. Just like, you know, when I was in pharmacy school and I was stealing those drugs, I was bending the rules. Why I didn't get busted for that, I don't, you know, that's a power greater than me kept me out of trouble. And also, in case any of you are interested, the statute of limitations is over. But I do a 10-step on a daily basis, and I do an 11-step on a daily basis. I pray and meditate in the morning and in the evening. I pray and meditate by myself, and I pray and meditate with my wife. And I get down on my knees every morning by myself, and I get down on my knees every morning with my wife. And that's part of our spiritual journey, and that has been one of the gifts of the program, that we have grown in recovery together. We were married 20 some years before I got sober, almost. And I've been sober 18 years, and our marriage now is a whole lot better than it was before I got sober. I must tell you that there were some rocky roads during that time, and at another time, another place, maybe we can discuss them. But there were difficult times in those 18 years that I've been sober. But we used the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon to get us through that. And I guess that's a metaphor for life, that there, any problem that I have, I can use the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to get me through it. Now, that doesn't mean that everything that's in, that every problem you have is in the big book of AA. Trust me, there's nothing about hemorrhoids in the big book of AA. And if I'm having chest pain, don't take me to a meeting, take me to the hospital. But the concept is that it gives me a way of living to understand that I can ask for help, and if that's from a sponsor or from a doctor to treat my chest disease or whatever, I can ask for help. And that's, I think, for me, that's a gift. Unfortunately, sometimes I don't use all the gifts that I've been given, but I have a 10-step to make me focus on where I'm supposed to be going. You know, if I don't ask for help, that's my self-centeredness again, that I can do it by myself. And trust me, that's one of my character defects. I'm sorry I said that in front of my wife, but... And I am a different person now than when I came into the program. I am a better person now than when I came into the program. And that's not boasting, that's a statement of fact. You know, without this program, I don't know where I would be, but I know it wouldn't be a good place. Unless some miracle happened. Because the way I was going, it was either jail or insanity or death. There was nothing else. You know, I was breaking felonies on a daily basis. And I was abusing my body with alcohol on a daily basis. Things were not going to get better. It was impossible. And I don't do that anymore. You know, when I came in here, I couldn't stop drinking. It was impossible to stop drinking. It was impossible to stop taking drugs. I don't do that anymore. A miracle happened. And because of that miracle, The only way I can keep it, and the only way I can keep that fresh, and the only way I can keep it sacred, is to share it with other people. And to help, and to give it to other people that are unfortunate. One of the jobs that I had when I first got sober, I was medical director of a detox at a local hospital. And I must have detoxed 10,000 people, 500 different ones. That means 9,500 keep coming back. I mean, you know, a lot of people, when we give them the message, they're not receptive the way we think they should be receptive. And boy, is that's my ego again. That's my, you're going to get it my way, and that's the only way. But that's not what it's about. It's sharing the message, and if they get it, that's okay. And if the seed is only planted, that's okay. And some people have to die from our disease. You know, some people have to relapse. Some people have to die from this disease to make AA work. If everybody that came through that door came in, got a chip, and they guaranteed they were sober forever, we don't need AA. Don't need AA. Some of us have to die from this disease for us to realize how precious this gift is. And, you know, I am, if you've been in AA long enough, you know people that have died from this disease, and I know many people that have died from this disease, and I've taken care of people that have died from this disease. And it's sad, it's frustrating, and it doesn't have to be that way. But and I don't know why some people die and some people don't. I do know that some of us have to die to make AA special. And that's a terrible price. It's a terrible price. But I know that I'm sober today. And I can't guarantee that I'm going to be sober tomorrow or the next day. Nobody can. But boy, what a precious gift we have. And I just want to thank you for sharing that special gift. And I guess I was supposed to lead tonight. Thank you.
Yeah, I guess you were, Bob. On behalf of myself and the entire group, I'd like to thank you for that. You know, there were quite a few things that were said that remain very important. But you shared with us this evening the most important thing any alcoholic can share with anyone else in this room. You shared your entire life with us. And also you made the comment about the seed being planted. You know, people have found seeds that are thousands of years old that still germinated after that length of time. And that's the same with planting the seeds in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't know when it's going to sprout. So we have to do the best that we can for each and every one of us that's in here. And I think you did that tonight. And then Baz said that I have to turn this back over to him. So, Mr. Baz.